When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Sip on the go with a Starbucks Iced Shaken Espresso. Our signature roast, shaken with ice, then finished with a splash of milk. Customize it to match your style on the Starbucks app. Make today a good day.
This is the Music Buzz Podcast. The Music Buzz Podcast features candid discussions with and about those behind the scenes in the music business, including industry veterans representing the segments of musician, design, and live. All three Music Buzz podcast hosts have spent their careers working with the biggest names in entertainment and have been and are still a fly on the wall. Dane Clark as the drummer for John Mellencamp's band for over 20 years and various solo projects. Hugh Syme, a world-renowned graphic artist for the biggest names in music and the corporate world. Andy Wilson, an award-winning marketing and public relations executive with over 20 years of combined multi-level entertainment industry experience in the music and sports business. Now let's buzz.
Hello and welcome back to the Music Buzz Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Andy Wilson, along with Dane Clark. Hey, Dane.
Hey, Andy. How are you doing today?
I'm good. And Hugh Syme. Hey, Hugh. How's it going?
It's going well. Thank you, Andrew. How about you?
I'm doing good. Hanging in there. Today, we're joined by the veteran rock and roll tunesmith, Marshall Crenshaw, whose beloved body of work encompasses 10 studio albums, as well as a variety of EPs and compilations and live discs. He got his first break in 1978, playing John Lennon in the musical Beatlemania. Songs such as Someday, Someway, Cynical Girl, Whenever You're On My Mind, co-write songs including The Gin Blossoms Till I Hear It From You, among others. He's appeared in motion pictures. He even portrayed Buddy Holly in La Bamba back in 1987, and has had his songs covered by the likes of Bette Midler and Ronnie Spector, to name a few. He also recently regained ownership of the five acclaimed albums he released on Razor and Tie label between 1994 and 2003. Welcome to the Music Buzz Podcast, Marshall Crenshaw.
Thank you, Andy. And hi, guys.
Marshall, glad you're here, man. So I'm going to dive back into your catalog a little bit. But first, let's just start off with the last thing that Andy was talking about. So that was almost 10 years worth of your stuff. Tell us what was going on with that, why you just got back the rights to that stuff.
Well, it was in the contract, you know, it's just lucky for me. I had a smart lawyer who thought of inserting that in there, and I didn't ask him to do it. They didn't balk. You know, the time, the day on the calendar rolled around, and, you know, yippee. I was like, really, you know, nothing like that was in any of my major label contracts. I just...
So what was it like, come 20 years, you get the rights to, they're yours again, or?
It was 15.
15 years? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, congratulations. That's awesome.
That's fabulous. And I noticed when I was going back through just Apple Music that I didn't see your first album in there. I saw some of the songs, of course, in compilations, but I didn't see that record on its own in there.
Mm. Do you already know the answer to that question?
I don't, no.
Oh, okay, because that's another cool thing is yay for U.S. copyright laws. I was able to claim the U.S. copyrights for my Warner Brothers recordings about 2 years ago or so. And, you know, what I keep saying to people, I just figured this out while I was talking to somebody last week, but I'm curating my legacy now. That's what I'm doing. You know, I've got the ability to just sort of make this stuff take the shape. You know, I just want to get it out there in a way that I think might sustain interest in this stuff.
Sure.
I mean, there is interest anyway, but...
Oh, no question.
I'm having fun with these reissues. I got a It's a 40th anniversary edition of my first album that's coming out November. I made a licensing deal with Yep Rock for the for the first two Warner Brothers albums.
Nice.
And I, you know, so that, yeah, I mean, that's what I'm doing. I've been kind of concentrating on that for the last year or so.
Well, that's very cool. I bought your debut record when it came out, and I remember that record and T-Bone Burnett's Trapdoor, which was like an EP.
Oh, yeah.
Those were my two favorite records that year. Both really smart pop, 60s influenced works that were kind of went against the grain of maybe what was going on at the time. So anyway, there she goes again. First song from the debut. What a killer tune, man. And a killer bridge, which was what caught me off guard the first time. And it's kind of one of your trademarks. And being a fan of Graham Parker, Elvis Costello, and of course the Kinks and the Beatles, that tune sucked me right in to listen to the rest of the record. Loved it.
There's another little element in that track that you might not have caught, but the drum beat, it's got like triplets on the eighth note, triplets on the hi-hat, yeah. You know,
sure.
Really pushes the whole thing along nicely.
Yeah.
And that beat, we got that one from a record called Backfield in Motion by Mel and Tim. And then It's All Right by The Impressions has eighth note triplets on the hi-hat. So, you know, we picked up on that. A little bit of this, a little bit of that, just throw it all into the
mix.
The hopper.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great groove. It's a great groove for sure.
You broke that timing rule on Some Hearts as well, which is a gorgeous song. I love that song.
I never heard of it.
Yeah, you have.
No, I'm kidding.
Well, so the second tune on that record was Someday, Someway.
All right.
Maybe one of your most well-known songs. You know, what can you say about that? Another classic pop shuffle.
I also had there's just certain sort of R&B thing going on in that song that made me think that even the Supremes, Diana Ross kind of vibe, that could have been covered by them beautifully.
Which one?
Someday, Someway.
Wow. Well, that would be interesting.
I like that idea, Hugh.
Guess what? There's a song by the Marvelettes called Someday, Someway. It's not my song.
Okay.
But, I remember that now because I learned that at the time my record was out. I loved the Marvelettes and thought I knew all their records, but I didn't know that. I still haven't heard Someday, Someway by the Marvelettes. I got to check it out sometime, right?
I'm going to have to.
Today's the day. Yeah.
So Cynical Girl, Ray Davies were the, or Davis, if you're English lyrically and melodically. Great song.
Thank you.
Yeah. One of my favorites. Now, here's one that's a little maybe unknown to some of our listeners. From your Downtown record, which I had, which I thought was really good, too.
Yeah.
Blues is King.
Yeah.
Killer melody and kind of a lot of major seven chords, a chord structure that changes keys kind of during the chorus, almost in a Brian Wilson-y kind of a way, and then snaps back for the verse. That's really nice writing, man. Really,
thank
really
you.
Cool tune.
Yeah, I think it is a really nice piece of music. And, of course, I binged on Brian Wilson for a long time, and I could turn right around tomorrow and start all over again with him.
Yeah, me too.
If there's any influence of him in my stuff, it's for obvious reasons, you know.
Yeah. So You Should Have Been There from the Good Evening record, man. That should have been a hit. That's a cool tune, man. I love the 6-4 intro thing that kind of keeps coming back. That's a nice tune.
Great. I was doing my best, back at that point in time. It was like the situation with Warner Brothers and me was pretty much ruined after the second album. But I had
Field Day record.
Yeah. After that, I wanted to leave. I wanted them to drop me, and I begged them to do it, but they wouldn't. So I carried on after that. For me, the Warner Brothers stuff falls into Group A and Group B. Post all that and pre all of that. So anyway, thanks for the compliment on that song. Like people talk about influences on me, I just say that it's that I was influenced by like the totality of top 40 radio, like 50s and 60s. It was always eclectic and diverse. If you looked at a chart in the mid 60s, you might see James Brown next to Petula Clark.
Yeah,
and then you're going to see like Dean Martin and some MOR pop like that. You're going to see like whatever six Motown records are on the charts that week, whatever six British Invasion records are in the charts. But it's just like the whole mix of it is what I love and loved then.
Yeah, AM radio was fantastic back in the day, man.
That's what I knew and grew up with. Yeah, so
sure.
I see that affection for the 50s mid-century vibe, even in your artwork, your cover, your album cover artwork. We'll get to that, but I see that sort of percolating through there.
Yeah, that's, you know, home base is the stuff that I loved as a kid. But it's not. It's not the only thing that I've obsessed over. I have like a big picture view of popular music. You know, from like I've got records, and you guys probably do too. But I have favorite records that were recorded back near the dawn of recorded sound. And then I have favorite records that were done last year or last month. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So
yeah,
that's really, you know, big picture is where I'm at. You know?
Sure. Well, the other album project I actually wanted to talk about, and it was one that I hadn't heard until yesterday, was the Jagged Land. And I love the stripped down rootsy approach on that record. I want to mention the song especially, Right on Time, Passing Through, Stormy River, love that one. Eventually, great lyrics, and Long Hard Road, great record, man. I mean, as a listen for a whole album, that would be my pick. Really cool.
Nice.
It came out in 2009, I believe.
Yeah, 2009. Yeah,
very cool. I'm sorry that I didn't hear it till now. You know, great, cool stuff.
Good, thank you. Yeah, I was really trying hard on that one.
Man, your guitar playing and your thoughtfulness of what not to play and what to play especially comes to fruition on that record just because it's so stripped down. It's beautiful, man.
That's a good point, because I'm trying now. Especially if I'm going to play a solo, now I try to play nothing. It's just like start with the idea of playing nothing and then see if what happens after that. But, you know, I like... When I was doing the other Razor and Tie reissue thing two, three years ago, that was an album of mine called Miracle of Science. And I actually took a scalpel to some of that just because I had to, and I knew that I could if I wanted to, because it's my stuff.
Is that so you could more effectively play it live?
No, it's because what I heard a lot on that record was what I call maximalist guitar solos, where I'm just really, you know, like digging in and playing a lot of notes. So I figured like I caught up with my quota of notes for my life, and now I'm just like not trying to play any notes. But
so you took the master tapes and reorganized them.
On the Miracle of Science reissue, I remixed two songs. That's all, I remixed them, and in remixing them, I kind of fooled with the arrangements a little bit.
Okay.
But I mean, I love that album. It's one of my favorite ones of mine, but there were like two tracks where on one of them, I didn't like the drum machine sound. I used to like to play with drum machines and, you know, it was always fun. And I'd spend a lot of time on it and get real meticulous on a track on Miracle of Science called Only an Hour Ago. I just thought it's too abrasive. It's not a cool sound. It doesn't fit the lyrics. Mm. So I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I just set up one microphone and played live drums with brushes along to the track? That might be better than the drum machine. But the crazy thing was I got the 8-8 tape out with the multi-track on it. I put the tape in, and there already was a track of me doing that. I must have done it back right after I finished the album. But there it was. It was a track of me playing live drums to it. So I just... What I wound up doing was put the drum machine here and then the live drums here. You know, I did little stuff like that. Actually, not so little, but
yeah.
But those are the only two times I've ever done that. Like the reissue of number 447, I didn't tamper with anything because, you know, there was no need. It's a great album all the way through. And that's what I'm doing now. I could do this stuff if I feel like it, you know.
Awesome. So Andy York said, I said, what obscure question can I ask Marshall that nobody would know about? And he said to ask you about Flare Gun. And I assume that's different than Theme from Flare Gun.
No, that's what he means.
Is that it? Okay.
Yeah.
See, he had a big smiley face. So is there a story there that we should know? It's a cool tune. If it's the instrumental, that's a really cool kind of Spanish style instrumental. It's really cool.
Thank you. Yeah, that was the first instrumental track that I ever put on a record. And that would have, you know, that would never have flown with an A&R department at a major label.
Sure.
They wouldn't have let me do it. But, you know, it was just like a little salute to Hank Marvin and the Shadows, kind of.
Yeah.
But it's a tune I wrote when I was writing the songs for Downtown. I was, you know, really in a mental rut and a spiritual rut also. But I kept pushing, you know, and so I had that piece of music. Flare Gun, which turned out to be Flare Gun. I tried to get some words onto it. I couldn't think of anything. I asked Jules Shear to write some words. He wrote a lot of words and they were really good. And I, you know, still feel like I owe him an apology because I just decided that the song was better without any words. That's all. And so I got out my Stratocaster and put some Hank Marvin Echo on it. And off I went. But that I did everything on that track except for the Mellotron strings.
I always like to ask songwriters such as yourself who excel, who are real wordsmiths, which typically come first for you, the words to which you write the melody, or do you find melodies and then herniate to find the words to fit the melody?
It's that way. I write the music first, and that's my favorite part of the whole thing. And then, you know, my real favorite part of the whole thing is recording it. And if I'm starting it up by myself, then, you know, I really like making the basic track and just kind of getting into that whole sound world. That's my favorite part of it. You know?
So I have a question for you. So when we look back at your career and some of the stuff I highlighted on the intro, you know, the Beatlemania thing, you've obviously been involved in motion pictures, you know, so many records, co-writes, et cetera, et cetera. But the one common thread seems to me is just this, like, you know, you stay true to clearly the type of music that you like. But there's just this interesting thread of pop music, whether it's playing Buddy Holly and La Bamba, whether it's the Beatlemania thing, whether it's, you know, the Jim Blossom song. I mean, that song is an amazing song, came out in the 90s, but it could have came out during the 60s too, and been just
that's
as
true,
good,
you know? Yeah, or the 70s, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So, I think that's a compliment to you, and obviously, maybe do you even realize you're doing that? I guess, you know, that you kind of stay true to that. Is that just who you are, or, you know?
I guess so. Yeah, like I said before, I grew up with 50s and 60s top 40.
Yeah,
and I'm not stuck in that era, but, you know, like if you think about, you know, how many pop songs and song structures have been drilled into my brain,
right,
from all that listening. And the thing is, I'm a good listener, you know, like I remember details and I can't hear. I mean, I wish that my ear was better than it is, but, you know, for mostly kind of harmonically simple stuff that was on the radio back then, I really could comprehend it and remember it. So,
and to deconstruct what you're listening to where you can actually hear and break down the parts. I always found that fascinating with the Beatles and even early Elton John. It was just great to get inside the tracks.
Yeah, for sure. My brain can do that. I don't know why, but it can. So,
well, I got a question for you. I know I've got seven of my own records out and do producing and stuff. And, you know, you listen to stuff as you're working on it so much that you hear in all the details, and sometimes you can't just hear the song. Do you find yourself, when you can go back to, say, your first record and play the ninth song on it, can you take yourself, instead of wanting to go back and remember in all the details, can you just enjoy it as a cool song now?
It just kind of depends, you know, on the song, whether I can enjoy it or not. But yeah, I guess, sure, you know, like for a few years I played solo a lot. At my gigs, I would just go by myself. And so that really, you know, threw everything in relief.
Always guitar or
in a different way?
Do you play keyboards at all?
Not really, you know, not competently. So yeah, just guitar. I'm a guitar player and then a wannabe drummer on the side.
Well, I always sort of say that Neil Young is not a competent piano player, but what a resourceful player he is. For all of
he gets
stuff.
The point across, yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
gets the job done.
He sure did.
So I have to ask you about La Bamba. So, you know, there's been so many, you know, music biopics or whatever that have come out over the last, seems to be one of the new hot things, right? to me, I always measure, it's like, is it better than La Bamba? That's what I, my, it's always the question in my mind, always the question I ask. It's tough to find one that's that good, man. I mean, how did that happen for you, and how did you become Buddy Holly in the movie, and what was that experience like for you?
It just was the fact that, you know, I was out there, and I don't know, it just was a lucky thing that came out of left field. I had a friend from high school who was out in Hollywood, a guy named Carl Bressler. I'll check his name. The Carl Bressler, and he's in some movies, you know, like he's in one where he's in a scene with Liza Minnelli. He's in one where he's gets beat up, I think, by Kevin Spacey. And anyway, Carl, you know, called me one day and said that he'd heard a rumor that they were going to ask me to play Buddy Holly in a movie. And I don't know, if I like panicked a little bit or something, or I just kind of went, well, me, why, you know, or, you know, I was hearing that all the time back then, you know, oh, he's the new Buddy Holly.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Or seriously, people would write that, you know.
Right.
And it like, it, you know, made me feel weird somehow, but that was easy to do back then. But anyway, I was sort of ambivalent about the idea at first, but that was one instance where I got saved from my own stupidity by smarter people than myself who, you know, said, well, shut up and do it. Okay. You know, which is the right thing to do. And,
well, you were so good in it, man. Not
yeah,
just
man,
the singing. The singing's great. The part that you would expect to be good is good, but just the acting alone, I mean, it's fantastic. I mean, you
thank you. Yeah. I don't know what happened. You know, I was in the scene.
Yeah.
I don't know how I did any of that, but you know, it's just like, well, I'm here. I better show up, you know?
That's great.
To that comment, I don't know how it happened, because you listen so carefully to music and you deconstruct music as you're hearing it. Do you think you were doing that as you watched your favorite actors and your and other people who were good at conveying, you know, a presence or a personality? Do you think it came to you because you've been fascinated by actors other than yourself, or other than believing that you could be an actor?
Well, no, you know, if it was unconscious, if it was like that, because I didn't really ever think that I wanted to be an actor, honestly. But I know what you mean. I mean, that's movies is another thing.
Well, super cool. That's it. It's, I had to ask about that.
I got to watch it again.
Yeah.
I love that it happened. And, I, you know, that was my second time on a film set that year, because earlier that same year we were in Peggy Sue Got Married, again, a Buddy Holly reference, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
So anyhow, at least that when I did La Bamba, I'd already been on a movie set once. So.
Well, before you got on, Dane and I were talking about Rock Hard, of course, too. I mean, we can't not talk
Walk
about
Hard.
That. Or Walk Hard. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. But that was amazing too.
Walk Hard, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. That was nice. I mean, the movies, the whole thing
it's
with
hilarious.
Movies has been a good thing for me over the years. A lot of, you know, the Gin Blossom song was a song written for a movie soundtrack.
Oh, that's right. It was. What was the name of that movie?
Empire Records.
Yes. Was Liv Tyler in that movie, right? Was she in that movie?
She was. You know, I've never seen the movie. But
yeah, I don't remember the movie. I remember the tune, though. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's a cult favorite. But
yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. Anyway.
Cool.
Well, the Dewey Cox story, your demo, I listened to that. It's fabulous. I'm just.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
That was,
brings a smile. It is what it is. You know, it's great.
That was cool. Well, after I wrote the theme song to that.
You had to be chuckling while you were writing it. I mean, it's a cult.
Oh, I was, you know, I loved the script when they sent it to me. You know, it really looked amazing on paper. It's one, you know, I saw it later and it was a little tainted because I knew everything that was going to happen when I saw it the first time. But I guess if you didn't know what was going to happen, then it would blow your mind.
Oh, yes.
I read the script. I'm just like, this can't miss. I read the scene where he slices his brother down the center with a sword. And I'm like, this is going to be a smash, you know? And, but, you know, there's like a lot of songs. There were a lot of songs in the movie. And the way the script was, is that they had the titles for each song. They knew the titles that they wanted. So they would ask songwriters, well, why don't you try this one? You know, so then they would get 20 songs, different songs of that title, right? And the first one I did was one called Take My Hand, which didn't wind up in the movie. But, you know, I finished Take My Hand and I thought, I nailed it. They're going to love it. So I sent it in And they said, oh, this is great. Why don't you take a crack at the theme song? Not knowing that they were asking 50 other people to write a song called Walk Hard. But somehow the one I did was the one. Well, I know why they picked it. But anyway, it was fun. You know, it was just a great experience all around.
Yeah.
That's right.
What Warner office were you dealing with? What, Burbank or?
Wow, that's a really good question. I'm telling you, it is. No, I was an East Coast signing.
Okay.
And I didn't know that that was a problem or possibly a problem. I didn't know that, but it turned out to be one. But yeah, I was an East Coast signing. The East Coast office, it was explained to me many years later, they were like kind of like a poor cousin of Warner Brothers, right? I didn't know any of that.
Well, I was fortunate when I lived out in L.A. for an unwitting 16 years. I planned to stay for 6 months. I had a lot of dealings in the hallowed halls of Burbank Warners, and it was a fabulous campus. I mean, I call it.
Yeah.
The way it was built, the way everything kind of looked in on itself, it was a hornet's nest of activity and good cross pollination. And I actually think, you know, if not that your career had any issues at all, but I think signing with that side of the country, that was a pretty hip label out west on a lot of levels.
And in New York, too, you know, it was great. And I liked the people that worked at that place. They really liked to be at work. You know, it was a great workplace and a real good atmosphere. And same in New York, too. And I met a lot of some of my favorite people I've ever known. I met at the New York office and in the Burbank office.
Yeah.
There's just the ones that I hated that gave me problems.
Right. And I hated the people I hate give me problems. That's right. You know, I hate them for that.
Yeah. It's going to happen. It's going to happen.
So we always like to talk about album covers because of Hugh's vast catalog of legendary album covers. So I'm going to pass it over to Hugh and let him take the reins for a minute here.
And sometimes I kind of get on these podcasts and I think, it doesn't look like this guy cares about artwork too much. And I kind of dread asking. Clearly you have had a hand in, because your level of wit in your lyrics is evident, I'm presuming. But when I looked at what's in the bag, what a beautiful cover that is. It's just so sinister and whimsical at the same time, you know. I may be overthinking it, as a lot of people do with my own covers, but Life's Too Short, just featuring the dog somehow made sense. You think of Dog Years, Good Evening, just the flashlight artwork on the bicycle.
Oh yeah. And
just the fact that you're acknowledging twilight and the power of opening the camera and a light. You have a great sort of self-effacing sort of photojournalistic style too. And then of course, Miracle. It looks like it could have been a Teen Beat 65 cover for Sandy Nelson or something. That's why I acknowledge your possible fascination with mid-century. Even the tableware on the Marshall Crenshaw cover,
right,
with the sunglasses. That just looks like record, yeah. You would have chosen those props.
I did have, you know, I had a hand in with everything. I mean, as you were going through that list, I just thought of all the great people that I worked with and how lucky I am, you know. But, I mean, let me see. The first album, the sort of like the set design for the album cover on the first album was a guy named Gary Green and his girlfriend Christina Delancey. And they had also done the artwork for the first record I ever made, which was just single on the Shake Records label. Christina and Gary, you know,
yeah.
I think with my role in that was just to say, oh, I like this picture, you know, like choose the photograph, I think is what I did. But they, you know, they were kind of taking their cue from their impressions of me, you know, like they were trying to do something that they thought fit my character and personality. So they got all these old dishes and put them on the table. And then, but the guy with the lightsaber on Good Evening was a guy named, I think, Dean Chamberlain.
Uh-huh.
But then I might not have the name right anymore. But he also did the very same thing on my fourth album, which is called Mary Jean and Nine Others. Not my favorite album title that I came up with. But anyway, there's light painting on that one, too. And that one, that's my favorite album cover of ours. It just looks like an LSD trip or something. And I mean that in a good way.
But I like your photojournalistic, you know, like I say, the random, candid feel. A lot of people get very narcissistic when it comes to themselves on album covers. But, yeah. You know, when I look at the Wild Exciting Times, I mean, it just feels, it's incredible. It's a lovely moment. And yet, you know, a lot of people would say, well, that's just a snapshot. Well, yeah, it is.
That's me and my brother. But yeah. You know what happened to me was I hated the cover of my second album so much, Field Day. And that was the time when I left it entirely in other people's hands. So, like, I never did that again.
Wait, you're talking the tool with the Volkswagen bus?
No, the one I hate is the one where it's just my big, giant head.
Yeah.
I look like, you know, it looks like a light bulb with glasses or something. And then in the background is a montage that I didn't do. But I went on a vacation after we finished the second album, my wife and I. And my brother, too. We all went to Prague, Czechoslovakia, because my brother's girlfriend was working on a movie there. And we just thought, well, this would be amazing. So we went over there. And then I came back and I was presented with a mock-up of the album cover. And I just said, I hate this. You got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
And the guy mm-hmm. said, the manager, it was, he said, well, you know what? If you want to change it, it'll delay the release of the album by 2 weeks. Like that was a big deal, you know? And he said, then, you know, you got your touring schedule. And I thought, okay, 2 weeks. Well, I guess I better just say yes to this. And I like regretted it every day of my life since then. But that way, again, I learned my lesson from that, you know?
You learned your lesson. Did that again.
Yeah.
Oh, I got one really obscure question. And this I remember from when you were in Atlanta, I was with Andy York and we had a conversation. God, I don't know, man, 7 or 8 years ago.
At least.
The Tom Wilson. Well, yeah, you were making a movie or going to make a movie about Tom Wilson, the producer for The Velvets and Dylan.
Yeah.
Eric Burden in The New Animals, Country Joe and the Fish, a couple records later period stuff from them.
I'm still doing it.
Are you still doing it?
This is the year that it's going to get finished. But I was talking to my son last night about it. He wanted an update. And while I was talking to him, I realized that he's 23 or 4 now. I'm sorry that I can't remember the exact number, but he was 13 when I started talking about doing it. So like a lot of his life, right?
Hmm. So what stage is it in? I mean,
good question. There's an editor and there's a director and then there's my producer, me, and then there's other producers too. And I also have a writer collaborator, great, amazing team. And I've got like a little bit of an agenda left of interviews that I personally want to do, but it's a really short list now. It's down to like a list of 3 or 4. I'm kind of laying the groundwork for when we really get the money and the real budget to do it. So I have some funding, but anyhow, what I'm just kind of telling myself now is I'm laying the groundwork for the director, but I've been creating content for it now since 2016 and doing research and gathering content for it since 2016.
Wow.
I really feel like if it's going to be this year, and I mean that.
Cool. So to our listeners, it's the guy that was the producer on Bringing It All Back Home, Highway 61, the first 3 Velvet Underground records.
The only thing on Highway 61 he did was Like a Rolling Stone.
Okay, that's right. He bailed after that, didn't he?
He was Dylan's producer from Masters of War, you know, like the last session for the Freewheeling album, because there were like 6 sessions for it, and Wilson came on board at the last one, and then he did the next 2 albums. Next 3 albums, which if you think about that sequence and that chunk of Dylan's chronology, it's like super, super significant.
Oh, yeah. Times They Are A-Changing, Another Side, Bringing It All Back Home.
It's weird to sort of put it this bluntly, but Wilson took credit for convincing Bob to go electric.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he did begin to advocate for it right at the start. You know, back in 63, he was pushing the idea, pushing it.
What's the Dylan tune where there's a band that was a 45 out that came out in 62?
Yeah.
Karina. There's a whole band on that record.
That's right.
And was that Tom Wilson?
No, it's John Hammond. And Bob, you know, later said that he wasn't into that and it wasn't that's, you know, that's, they resisted the idea when Wilson brought it up because they'd already done it. Didn't like the outcome of it. But anyhow, he was a game changer in popular music.
Yeah, the first Velvet's record, for Pete's sake, man.
Well, he didn't just produce that record. He enabled it to exist and to come out into the world, because Wilson's gig at that time was, he was the head of the pop recording division of MGM Records.
Right.
And he, and you know, so there were the records that have his name on them as producer, but he also had to green light other signings like Richie Havens and, you know, Tim Hardin, whoever else you can think of.
Sure.
That recorded for that, you know, it was all, he had to sign off on it, or otherwise
I didn't realize that. Yeah.
Get onto the label. Yeah, he was a, you know, he was a bit, he was a power broker and a gatekeeper, and he was the only one on earth at that time that was going to give the Velvet Underground a shot, and the same with Frank Zappa. And Zappa said so himself. He said, "We got turned down by everybody, which is good, because we wound up with Tom Wilson." He already knew who Tom Wilson was. But anyway, before any of the rock stuff and the folk stuff, Wilson had a jazz record label that he established himself in 1955. And they put out the first Cecil Taylor album and the first Sun Ra album.
Oh, wow.
So he's just, it's provocateurs when you look at his bullet points. And then Simon and Garfunkel, there would be no such thing as them if it wasn't for Tom Wilson. That's literally true.
He overdubbed the band on Sound of Silence.
But before that, he produced the, you know, the instruments that were overdubbed onto an acoustic version of the song. Wilson produced that one too.
Right.
And I know the whole backstory. I've got everything, all of this double, triple corroborated, you know. If it wasn't, sometimes you read the story of the rise to glory of a musical artiste and you find out that it's just, it's one person who gave them the shot that they needed, and there wasn't going to be anybody else to do it at that time. And Wilson was that gatekeeper for all the people I named. And, you know, he's just a giant, right? And that's what killed me when I figured out who this guy was. I'm like, whoa, why don't I know about all this? I'm supposed to be like knowledgeable about this stuff, and I never put this together. And it's like, come on, you know, it's a giant story. He was a giant. And where's the recognition, people?
You got to finish this thing up, man.
Yeah.
I'm going.
I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So apart from being that giant who could recognize the entire artist, did he get into the weeds and start, did he act as A&R on a lot of levels or no?
That's a good question. He was, you know, his thing was like, he said that his approach was to get a bunch of people in a room that all, you know what they're doing and sort of act as a referee. You know, he started as a jazz producer. So the ethos was, you do the recording session, make sure everybody's comfortable and they can do what they do. And then later, the producer's the guy who stands back later and judges it, you know, decides what to do with the recording session, which is the right take. He does that in isolation. Wilson, that was how, you know, when he came up as a record producer in those days. So when he did rock records, it was the same thing. He just, his take was to have the, his ethos was to have the recording session, and then he and his engineer would like figure out what it was all supposed to mean and what to do with it. We crafted.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. Pre Roy Haley, right?
Wilson gave Roy Haley his start.
Oh, wow.
Wilson said in an interview that I have, more than one interview, he said, yeah, he was proud that he had brought Roy Haley up from the editing room. He was the first producer to use him on a session.
He had ears, that boy.
Yeah, you think?
No, forget it. Tom Wilson, you know, everybody that cares about popular music, especially in our age demographic, should know a lot about Tom Wilson. They're going to know a lot about him.
That's awesome. Good, man.
Yeah, that's great.
Fantastic.
It's fun. I mean, I'm having such a great time with it, too. You can hear how enthusiastic I am.
Yeah.
Super cool.
Great.
There's also the movie in the works right now with Tom Hanks playing the Colonel. On that,
really,
the 68 comeback special, which is obviously the NBC
moment
when Elvis kind of invented the unplugged in the round with his guitar.
Yeah,
sure.
That was headed up by director Steve Binder, and Steve did Hullabaloo and all these shows back in the day. He would produce Petula Clark and all these people. So when it became evident that he wasn't digging being in Vegas and Hawaii while the Beatles were soaring, he was just playing all these kind of B movies. Elvis said, "You've got to do something." So Steve came up with this idea of doing a special. The Colonel's first idea was to put him in a cardigan with kids around. It was supposed to be, he wanted it to be a Christmas special. He wanted to do an Andy Williams with him, with, you know, a fireside scene and so on. He said no. So
that would have sucked.
Yeah. So, but it really launched his career again. But
don't you think, though, did they not dress him kind of up like Jim Morrison in 1968? He'd never worn leather before, had he?
Morrison already featured that in his career at that point. I don't know.
Yeah, Morrison had, he started out with the leather. Yeah. So I always thought the Pelv was kind of doing a Jimbo there. Maybe
looking for drool.
No, it was still great. No, it was. He was great. He was great on that.
Yeah, I love it. I watched it when it was on. I saw it.
I did too.
On the night. Did you? Yeah.
Yeah. 8 years old. Checking it out.
Very excited.
So on that note, on the live front, a couple live related questions. So I know you've gone out and performed with the Smithereens since Pat's passing. How did that come about? Doing that.
It kind of like took shape after this memorial show that happened for Pat. The band was supposed to be on a double bill show with Patti Smyth and Scandal at the Count Basie Theater in Red Bank, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And then hosted by Little Steven. But then Pat died during the December before the show was supposed to happen. So they decided to make it into a multi-artist tribute show to Pat. And it was like a really memorable, uplifting kind of thing, you know, for me and for everybody. You know, it was really like a beautiful thing. And that's funny, you know, sometimes someone's death, the aftermath of it can be. Anyway, I remember when my dad died, we had this amazing party for him. And anyway, Pat passed away, and I played three songs with the band, with the guys that night, with Mike, Dennis, and Jim. And I really liked it, you know, and they really liked it. So a little while later, Dennis reached out to me, asked me if I would do a TV show with them that they were supposed to do. And so I did. And then maybe another month or 6 weeks later after that, he asked if I would do some tour dates with them. So I did. Because, you know, I'm still in the aftermath of the memorial service. I'm still trying to keep the buzz going. And anyway, I've just been kind of, you know, I get the phone calls and the emails and I just say, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And because it's, you know, it's just like really turned into this fun thing.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And we're old friends. I mean, I've known those guys always, like, since forever.
Such a good band, man. They're
a great band.
Really underrated, in my opinion. I mean, there's certainly, I always find that big fans of rock music and folks that follow it certainly know the Smithereens, but man, there's so many good songs there. So many
people come out to the shows, I'll tell you that. And they do. And so it's just fun. I mean, how can I resist? You know, they're just a great rock and roll band.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I remember they opened up for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Oh, yeah. Tour.
And, you know, obviously the Tom Petty fans knew who they were, but it's one of those bands that, like, I think just a lot of the crowd maybe didn't, too. But just being, you could see people just being introduced to them for the first time, and then people being reminded how great they are.
So you were at one of those shows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, one more live question. What was the first show that you went to as a fan that you paid, went and bought a ticket for, that you were excited about as a fan?
Oh, boy. Well, I used to see local bands in the Detroit area, but I think the first big time rock and roll band that I ever saw. But the thing is, I didn't specifically buy a ticket to see them. They were at the Michigan State Fair, but it was Gary Lewis and the Playboys.
Oh, wow.
I saw them. Yeah, I saw them. And, you know, at the time I liked them. And so it was great to see them. And they had, you know, Gary was hooked up with Leon Russell. So there were all these Tulsa guys in the band who could really play, you know, like
Was Leon there?
No, he wasn't. But the drummer was either Jimmy Carstein or Jim Keltner. I can't say.
Oh,
but
wow.
Like the guitar player was a guy named Tom Triplehorn, who was like a kind of a James Burton disciple. It was just great. And Carl Radel would have been in the band at that time.
Oh, Carl, yeah.
So I saw them, you know, and that was really a gas. I loved it. But then after that, the Detroit bands started to happen. And I was a big fan of some of those in particular. And
yeah, so who did you see from that era back then, like MC5 or any of those guys back in the day?
I did. I saw the MC5 about four times. I saw the Stooges once, but that was crazy memorable. And but there were so many, you know, like the Detroit scene in the summer of 1969, it really looked like it was, you know, Liverpool and the whatever. It was a really big deal, and it looked like it was going to just break wide open nationally, which never did, but who cares, you know. It was really so much fun to
Tell us about the Stooges when you saw them.
I went to this thing called the Rock and Roll Revival at the State Fairgrounds, and there was a big show all day long. I can't remember who the very first band was to play, but it was all the Grandy Ballroom bands all in one day. And so any of them that I hadn't seen before, I'd already seen the MC5 a couple times by then, but all the others that I had never seen because I was too young to go to the Grandy, they were all there in one day. So the Stooges, they were like third from last to play. I just had, you know, I was completely stunned, honestly. It was like, this is a whole new kind of show business, right?
Sure.
I mean, Iggy, he was amazing, you know, and it was also like a big crowd, like 20,000 people. I mean, really. And they, so that's my only time that I ever saw them. So, you know, they could command a crowd of that size. And it was right when their first album was about to come out. All the songs from their first album, they just played all those. And I Want to Be Your Dog. I mean, the lyrics.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Everything. Iggy's, you know, the way he would, you know, flip off the audience and the whole. I mean, it was wild, you know.
Like, I'll bet.
No, this is a whole new kind of show business right here. So I'm glad I saw them. But then there was also like Ted Nugent and the Amboy Dukes. I really liked them.
They were great.
MC5 played. That was the last time I ever saw them. That was when the Back in the USA album was coming out. But then I also saw the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band that day.
Oh, wow.
I saw the James Gang with Joe Walsh. Dr. John the Night Tripper. Yeah, they played at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And Grand Funk Railroad, their world debut, which was a debacle.
Really?
You know, that's my fanboy story.
What a day. For music, man.
Yeah, it was cool.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Marshall. We really appreciate your time. Yeah, it was great.
Nice chat, man. You guys are my peers, you know. So thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, of course.
Our pleasure, man.
And congrats that you have so much of your own music back. That's a good
thing. Yeah, man. That's awesome.
Thank you. Be well, guys.
Yeah. Yep. Take care.
Take care, Marshall.
Bye, Marshall.